Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You're listening on WIPR. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780, or email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. And why would you want to call us? Well, it's St. Patrick's Day. I saw the people, all the green foolishness going on yesterday.
How fun.
But yeah, we're live today, and we have a special surprise in our second segment for you.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very special guest. But in the first segment, I would like to hear honestly what people's. I never celebrated St. Patrick's Day so much.
Me either.
And it's a giant thing in the city.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely. I noticed that when we first moved here.
And there are more Irish people than you think in this city. And there are lots of pretend Irish people in this city that or, enjoy St. Patrick's
wannabes.
Day.
Wannabes, yes. Well, that makes sense.
And so I think it'd be really interesting to hear from listeners if they have particular traditions.
Oh, definitely would love
or
to hear
Or recipes or mm-hmm. some sort make, of ridiculous.
How they turn their beer green.
I don't know if I want to know that.
How do you think they turn the river in Chicago green for St. Patrick's Day? How do you turn an entire river green? I saw a picture of it. I mean, I grew up 100 miles away from Chicago.
I wonder
Chicago
if they and, still do because it just
well,
doesn't
do.
Sound
just,
super eco-friendly.
Well, it doesn't. That's funny that you said that because they do still do it because I just saw a picture of it the other day. And yeah, I was thinking that too. I'm like, wait, how, because it's right on Lake Michigan. So I'm like, wait, where does all that green stuff go and what do they use?
I don't know. If you know the answer to this or one of the other mysteries of life,
yes,
you can call us.
Yes, mysteries of life.
410-662-8780 and bring light to it all.
What's your favorite hangover food, Tony? I think we're going to talk about that as well.
It has been a long time since I've had
back in when your college days
hangover.
When you had a hangover, what would you do then back
I mean,
then?
When I was in school at Texas Christian, I mean, it was the same thing. I mean, tacos, something. Taquitos. That was really the thing.
Oh, I love taquitos.
Mm, taquitos.
That, yummy. That sounds like good.
Was something
good
ridiculously
idea.
Like creamy, spicy to dip them into and lots of pickled jalapenos and something to get your full attention, you know, something good and spicy.
Definitely.
But, yeah, no, that's been a while.
Yeah, it's funny when I...
It would require pearl beer.
What's that?
To wash it down.
What's pearl beer?
It is
from Texas.
A fine product from the state of Texas.
That's cool.
It is the Natty Bow of Texas.
Yeah, when I was in college, I was in the only independent dorm on campus, and it was the only co-ed dorm on campus. Lucky that I landed there, wasn't I? And so half the dorm was girls, the other half were boys.
That is what co-ed often can mean.
Yes, yes, I thought I'd define that. And when we would have a party, it would be like our entire floor. And so we all became really, I mean, we just had this huge group of friends. It was so much fun. And people from all walks of life and everything. So it was just a great group of people. And some of the guys ended up with a place off campus. And we would, they were working for the local Budweiser distributor. So it was always
You went to college with people that work for the
Budweiser distributor? Oh, yes, I did. It was perfect. It was just perfect. So we would have all these pony kegs lined up for when they would work. That's how they got paid. And so we would have these parties out at this house. And so, of course, everybody crashed there. And then I had never in my life had scrambled eggs with ketchup. Okay, maybe I'm sheltered. I don't know. Maybe that's normal. But I will never forget that. Okay, maybe that's just a weird story. But yeah. Scrambled eggs and ketchup. And every now and then when I get, I don't feel like something fancy. I have scrambled eggs and ketchup still to this day, every now and then. Just not, well, you know, I don't have hangovers either, like
I mean,
you,
the,
Tony.
The perfect call.
But,
oh, my goodness. The perfect call would be from someone Irish telling us their...
I want to hear the Irish, their traditional Irish hangover cure.
Or if you
cure.
Because there may be a few people dealing tomorrow with decisions imperfectly made today while celebrating...
Decisions imperfectly made.
The marvelous Irish St. Patrick.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think we have... we have some folks on the way. You can reach us 410-662-8780. Remember, in our second segment, we have a special guest who will lend a little expertise in what's actually going on in Ireland these days.
That's exciting. I can't wait to talk to him.
Food-wise, because that's, I know, outside of both of our our range.
Yeah.
But if there's one time to explore it.
Let's do it now.
It's definitely now.
Definitely. What a beautiful country.
Let's go to the call from Geertra. Geertra, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Well, I'm recovering from a cold, but other than that, Grand and dandy.
Okay.
Top of the morning to you.
Top of the morning. You're grand, not recovering from a hangover?
Grand and dandy.
No. Haven't started drinking yet.
Oh, okay.
Well, all I've got is scotch in the house.
Well, nothing wrong with that.
Wow.
I'm Scotch-Irish anyway. My mother's father was born in the States, as were all of his brothers and sisters, but his parents were from County Clare and County Kerry, I believe, and met in New York fresh off the boat.
Mm, nice. So, wonderful.
This is our family recipe for Irish soda bread.
Ooh.
The first thing you have to do is start 1.5 cups of dark raisins plumping in hot water, because you want them nice and plump. So that's mm-hmm. the first thing to do. And start your oven at 350, heating up. Have a greased cast iron skillet, 9 to 10.5 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Three Good. Cups of white flour, 2/3 cup sugar, 1 tablespoon of baking powder, 1 teaspoon of soda, and 1 teaspoon of salt. Sift those all together. Measure out 1 3/4 cup of buttermilk. That's about the only thing that people would have to go out and get. Everything else is pretty much stuff you'd find in your kitchen. I put 2 eggs into the measured buttermilk, beat that all until it's nice and smooth, and then pour in 2 tablespoons of melted shortening. I use butter.
Sure.
Why not?
Why not?
It's only 2 tablespoons.
Mm-hmm.
And then add your liquid to the dry, mix it up well, pour it into the greased iron skillet, bake it for an hour until it's done in the middle,
yeah.
And it's lovely.
Well, it sounds great.
The other thing I've got on the stove is I've got a brisket that I'm boiling that I've got some miscellaneous herbs in there. I don't like corned beef because you cook it and it's just kind of boring. So I've got saved pickle juice that I throw in there, and actually I didn't have enough, so I just threw some extra apple cider vinegar in there too.
Mm-hmm.
And once the beef's starting to fall apart a bit, then I put cabbage and carrots in there too.
So your beef is running a little more Teutonic than Irish, it sounds like.
Yeah. I like the zing. I like the zing.
That sounds great.
And then I do Culcannon, but my own twist on Culcannon. Culcannon's basically mashed potatoes with cabbage. I do it with cabbage and leeks.
Good. Good.
And a lot of milk and butter.
That sounds fantastic.
And, yep.
So you have a crowd coming to consume all this business?
Hmm?
Do you have a crowd coming to consume all of this?
Well, we'll probably eat off it for the rest of the week. It's my husband, me, and my son.
There you go. Sounds good. Nice. Thank mm-hmm. you for sharing all
and,
that.
And I'm transporting some of the soda bread to my mother.
That's nice.
Nice.
Now, the soda bread sounds very similar to Southern biscuits, actually. So that's interesting. That was interesting to hear you give that recipe. Very cool. Thank you for sharing.
Uh-huh. My pleasure.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thanks,
Thank Gertrude. You, and to you and all your listeners as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's nice. That's cool.
Yeah. And you can reach us 410-662-8780 if you have Irish factoids or food tips or recipes you'd like to share. We have a little bit of time for that. You can email us, foremanwolf@wipr.org. And if you want to email us any questions, we will have a guest on who I bet you can answer an awful lot more about Irish food than we can coming up in just a little bit, the next 5-10 minutes.
So what's your favorite experience on trips to Ireland, Tony?
I've not been.
Oh, you've only been to Scotland?
I've been to Scotland.
Yeah, I know you've been to Scotland. I didn't realize
okay,
you had been
so
to Ireland.
Okay, so here's the danger of ancestry.com.
Mm-hmm.
You discover that your family has not been telling you the truth for a long time.
Why are you
Irish? They say that you're German and you're Scot.
Uh-huh.
Which is what I've been sold.
Uh-oh.
Over time.
And?
And I find out that I'm German, but some German and some Scot and some English. And a bunch of Irish.
Huh, that's cool. Good. That's neat.
That makes my daughter's majority Irish.
Huh. Okay. Did one of those tests?
So I'm going to have to, yeah, I did one of those
Which
tests.
One did you do?
Ancestry.
Okay, that's cool. I'd like to do that
and,
someday.
Yeah.
Did they say where in Germany you're from? Does it pinpoint where you're from, or it doesn't go to that?
No.
Just the country?
Okay. I have a feeling that these tests will become more and more.
That's amazing. That's
serious
so cool.
As time goes along, but.
Oh, I definitely want to do that.
It's funny. You have like family legend, and then you have actual
Well, my mother just used to lie in general, and period. And apparently we didn't find out until we had a, until we had, she used to like to say we were English. And I'm like, wait a minute, what happened to us being German? And then she was like, oh no, we're English.
Your name is Wolf and your mother's,
but my mother's name
is
Liebhardt. Yeah, well, yeah. So
Liebhardt is a pretty
very German
name.
Yeah, and so we have a family reunion like 10 years ago, and my mom's cousin brought all this information about our family, and we're just, you know, as absolutely German as we could be. So really, right? I'm going to have to talk to my mom. You know, I don't know what's going on with her.
I don't know. That was an interesting thing.
That's cool, though.
I have irresponsibly not gone back to one of my genetic fatherlands.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I guess
you'll
I better
go there someday.
Get there.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. There's it's such a beautiful country. Love Scotland. Scotland.
I tell you, the cheese, Ireland and cheese.
Oh,
we've gotten so many great cheeses.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
I'm curious to. To talk to our guest about
the Irish
about cheese culture.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So when we come back, we'll have with us J.P. McMahon. He's a Michelin-starred chef, and he's got a million different things going on. His best-known project is Restaurant Anier. And we'll be live with him when we come back. You can still reach us, 410-662-8780, or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We're live today. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780, or email us, foremanwolf@wipr.org. And now we're joined by J.P. McMahon, a Galway, Ireland-based chef, restaurateur, author, and food educator, and sounds like a busy guy. He is culinary director of the award-winning Eat Galway Restaurant Group, which includes Anier Restaurant, and I hope I'm not saying that incorrectly, and Tartar Cafe and Wine Bar, among others. Anier has been awarded a Michelin star every year since 2013. That stuff doesn't happen so lightly.
That's amazing. That's great.
And Tartar Cafe and Wine Bar received the Michelin Guide Bib Gourmand Award for 2019. It's a good thing to look out for travelers, for sure. JP also runs Anier Boutique Cookery School. He is the author of Cava Bodega Cookbook, Tapas, A Taste of Spain and Ireland, in its third edition, and of 10,000 years of Irish food. That's a lot of history to get into. That's interesting to me. Due to be published in 2019, he joins us on the line from Toronto, where he's cooking at George Brown College. J.P. McMahon, welcome to Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine.
Hey, how's it going?
Really good. We're really excited to have you on.
Hi, good, J.P.
Good to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I know that it probably sounds like the biggest cliche in the world, but we spend a lot of time talking about a lot of food, a lot of European-based food. And here we roll into St. Patrick's Day and realize that we don't have any real background or real history mm-hmm. in Irish food, and that is the thing that everyone's intending to celebrate.
Yeah, I suppose it's a difficult thing. I suppose we're not known... for our food, or we haven't been known for the last, 20 or 30 years, at least when I was, growing up in the 80s and the 90s, and I suppose in the last 10 or 15 years, the Irish food has kind of transformed itself in a very interesting way, some of which pays tribute to the past, but also some of it which kind of looks at different contemporary trends and tries to remold itself. And I think most of it is very product-driven because we have such great products in Ireland, like our lamb and our beef and our dairy. And I think there's a learning from different movements that have happened in the last couple of years, like the Nordic Food Revolution, which kind of focused on what they had and then tried to make a cuisine out of that. And I suppose that's what we have tried to do in an ear.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool to hear. Can you give us, as you're writing 10,000 years of, or written 10,000 years of Irish food, just a little bit of historical perspective.
It's very interesting. I mean, most of the time when we think about Irish food, we think about, of course, the potato, we think about lamb stew, or we think about corned beef or that. And I suppose most of those dishes are products like the potato are relatively new. I mean, you're talking about at least maybe 200 years. And when I suppose started looking into the food on the island of Ireland in the context of this this book I'm writing, it goes all the way back until the first people that came to Ireland, which is about approximately 10,000 years ago. And they're still unearthing some of the possible maybe people there beforehand. And I thought it was very interesting to see what people were eating. And so, say, when the first people came, you had a diet that consisted like mainly of shellfish, river fish like trout and salmon and eel, a lot of wild herbs, a lot of tree nuts like hazelnuts, and then seaweed as well. And that diet kind of like is kind of a stable diet until the kind of, I suppose, the agricultural revolution in about like 4,000 or 5,000 BC, and then you get dairy and cattle and grain like barley, all of that comes into the Irish diet. And then you have that for predominantly for it's quite a stable diet into the new millennia, and then and that changes again with the Vikings, who bring a kind of Nordic tradition, like pickled herring, a kind of pickled wild mushrooms, like a lot of different stuff, and then the Anglo-Normans in the 12th century bring a lot of spices, and that's the first time spices come into the country about 800 years ago. And so it's always changing, and I suppose we have a very fixed idea of any type of food. Even if you think about British food, you think about American food, really what we're thinking about is probably the last 200 or 300 years. And if you go back beyond that, you generally find very, very interesting eating habits that are derived out of what people have to hand.
Is food in different quarters of different areas of Ireland very different one area to another? Historically and these days?
I definitely think you do have a divide between the people who are living by the sea and people who are living inland, and then you do have a diet that on the sea. I mean, if you try and look at contemporary instance of people using seaweed in their diet, and that's something seaweed is, and shellfish are two things that I'm very interested in terms of how we use them in Ireland and how we use them, and like that's predominantly a coastal diet. But I suppose the difficulty of thinking about Irish food is predominantly when you're thinking about food in Ireland, you're thinking about two different positions. You're thinking one of the the indigenous Irish who were, I suppose, colonised by the British, but then you also have a kind of Anglo-Irish tradition of a wealthier class of people who were Irish, but I suppose consider themselves part of the larger picture. And you have two very, very different diets. One that is very almost kind of peasant-driven food of the land that has predominantly a kind of diet based around milk, around dairy, around oats. And on the other side, you have this Anglo-Irish diet, which encapsulates could be anything like cinnamon or figs that could come from halfway across the world, and this could be like 200 years ago. And so it's, you have a kind of a dualism within Irish food that differentiates, and it's important, I suppose, to acknowledge that, because often when we think about Irish food, we want it to be one thing. And we want to kind of like the Anglo-Irish bit or the British bit isn't as Irish as the Irish bit. And I mean, I suppose that's probably not the right way of thinking about it. And it's a very complicated position to think about.
What were some of the ways they would prepare shellfish and fish back when it was so important to the diet?
I very, very simply, in terms of like over fire and of cooking mussels or oysters in the ashes of the fire,
steaming
or
them
over
open.
Over the fire to open them and then eating them straight up. I think that's, for me, that's a very contemporary way of of serving shellfish when you without a kind of, whether it's with lemons or spices or anything like that. And when we serve shellfish in the restaurant, we try and really think about, well, how does the shellfish taste and how do we represent that taste? And I mean, that's why I really love thinking back about how they would have cooked like 8 or 10,000 years ago over fire, and how they would have eaten that and eaten raw as well. So it's very product driven and not very technique driven, which is probably something that characterizes Irish food a lot.
I'm curious, how did you do the research for this 10,000 year book? Where are you getting your information? How are you figuring this out?
A lot of it is, let me see, some of it is in terms of archaeology, and then you're looking at kind of like midden beds, and a lot of it doesn't come from the food side of things, that you don't have a particular text that tells you about Irish food beyond like maybe the 18th or 19th century. Anything beyond that, you do have a lot of texts that will tell people that have looked at, say, what we call the big house tradition, and you will have recipe collections from aristocrats and that, and so that's quite well documented. Before that, it's very much looking at historical and archaeological texts, and I suppose I'm very interested in that, and sometimes you just comb through a whole book and you might get one reference to a particular type of fish or shellfish, and then sometimes it's quite an imaginative process, particularly when you have to make a recipe. And this is also one of the points that I'm trying to do in the book, is trying to represent different stages of food in Ireland. And so, like, how would they have prepared shellfish when they were hunter gatherers, or how would they have prepared wild boar in 5,000 years ago? And I suppose you're looking at different historical texts that look at how people lived.
So how do you translate all of that history and the passion for the history into the menu in your restaurant? Anir, am I saying it correctly?
Yeah, Anir, yeah. Anir means the west, or on here is like the west in Irish. And I suppose we always start with a specific product, so whether it's the oysters or whether it's the Connemara lamb that we have on at the moment, and then we don't use any spices in the restaurant, so we don't use anything from black pepper to cinnamon or star anise or anything like that. So you just literally start off with the product, and you have like salt and oil, and then you say, well, how are we going to cook it? And we cook it in various different ways, and then one of the main things is looking to the landscape and looking to, I suppose, the wild food tradition, and saying, well, what's in season at the moment? And for example, okay, we have wild garlic is just in season at the moment. In Ireland, it has just come up, and it has a leaf and it has a flower, and so it can be used in sauces. It can be used to make a kind of like a salsa or a pesto. And it's trying to represent the landscape in the food. And so it's very, the menu is always written in reverse. So we don't go looking for, I suppose, we don't write a dish and then go looking for it. We actually look for products. And then we try and build it up almost like little building blocks, and say, oh, we'll take this seaweed, or we'll take this vinegar or this salt, and it's like little building blocks, and then we try and represent the west of Ireland through our food.
That's amazing. One of our great loves for your country is the cheese that you all produce.
There's so much good stuff.
You produce so many amazing cheeses. What are some of your favorites that you might use in your restaurant?
I love the cheese. Is another really, really good thing to think about in terms of Irish food and its history. And we had a great tradition in the Middle Ages of making cheese, and that a lot of that left and went to Europe. And there are a few historians who will say that the French robbed the Irish cheese tradition and capitalized on it. But I won't comment on that. But I mean, some of the really great ones, JP. I love the bean down in West Cork, Durris, which is another
Durris is so good.
St. Tola is a goat's cheese produced in County Clare. Cushnatira, which means cheese of the land, is a sheep's cheese that's produced in Galway. And for me, it has a really wonderful taste, like manchego. And so I think because of the grass and because of the rain, like, we do have great dairy, which means we have great milk, and therefore we have this wonderful farmhouse cheese tradition, which was revitalized in the late 70s by Veronica Steele, who passed away, I think, 2 years ago, who made Malines, and her son makes that cheese now. And so any of your listeners, if they're ever in Ireland, check out one of the cheesemongers, or the Sheridans, or other ones in Dublin, and really, you can literally taste the whole of the country through cheese, and whether it's sheep, goat, or cow, blue cheese, or many, many different styles of cheese.
So let's take a minute and give us St. Patrick's Day. What do people eat? What are there particular food traditions that people maybe don't know about, or that we get completely wrong here in the States?
Yeah, but like the funny thing is, I think a lot of the food traditions that have come up around Patrick's Day come from the States, and so whether it's corned beef and cabbage. I mean, but for me, I mean, like, I'm not a purist by any means, and like, I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you have an amazing amount of immigration from Ireland to the States in the 19th century. And so why wouldn't people create dishes that reminded them of home? I mean, sure, the corned beef tradition in Ireland was gigantic. And if you take the parallel with music, I mean, a lot of people, when they think of Irish music, they think of Ireland. But most of the Irish music was written in the States. And of course, it was written by immigrants, and then it went back home to Ireland. And so there's a great cross fertilization. So when people say to me, "Oh, they have tradition wrong," I mean, I don't think we have particular foodstuffs that we eat on Patrick's Day that we don't eat on others day on other days. I mean, and if we do now, I think it's possibly influenced by the American tradition. But for me, I mean, I would love to see people eating more oysters and seaweed, but that might be very fanciful. If I went down on Patrick's Day and asked people to eat a lot of oysters and seaweed, they might prefer the lamb stew or the beef cheeks or like that. I think we have kind of forgotten about the seas to a certain degree, because our land is so good, and we have a tradition of kind of lamb and pork and beef, and they represent Ireland quite well. But we also have lovely fish that most of the time we forget about, and that's something that I'm very interested in kind of revitalizing, and just saying, well, I mean, different products like the three we mentioned earlier on, salmon, trout and eel, which are the three, I suppose, principal first fishes of Ireland. And salmon is very well represented, and I think a lot of people will eat salmon on Patrick's Day, whether it's smoked salmon or whether it's baked or poached. But it would be great to see more people eating fish like trout and also smoked eel, which is still produced up in Loch Ness in Northern Ireland. It's been produced there for, I think, for like 4,000 or 5,000 years, and it's a really wonderful product.
Loch Ness.
JP, we're gonna have to take a break in a second. Do you think we could keep you with us for just 3-4 minutes after that?
Yeah,
I'd love to bother you for a recipe or two for our listeners. I'm sure that we had a caller earlier that was talking about her soda bread recipe, and it might be interesting if you want to think about what a couple of essential things
I would love to hear about
perhaps
eel.
Could prepare at home.
If you have an eel recipe to share, that would be exciting.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
So when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, a few more minutes with JP McMahon, and we'll see if we can get into the suffering part of the program, the Chef's Challenge. All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780. Unsurprisingly, we're talking about St. Patrick's Day. We have with us a noted Irish chef, J.P. McMahon, from Galway, who has a Michelin-star restaurant there, Anir. And it seems like a whole bunch of other
amazing things going
book
on.
Projects and schools and all kinds of business going on. And I asked him to stay on with us for a few minutes to maybe talk about a few recipes for things that maybe people should be capable to to do on a day like today or any time if they wanted to celebrate Irish food.
Can you tell us about Soda Bread?
Yeah, absolutely. And we, interestingly enough, we serve soda bread in an ear and in tartare. And at the end of the meal in there, we always give our recipe to everyone there.
Oh,
and it's kind of like a little
nice
gift. I mean, I love recipes and I love the tradition of Irish soda bread. So we give everyone that recipe. So if you want to email me, I can send you on our specific recipe, so you can send it on to any of your listeners.
That's nice.
And it's a slightly different soda bread. It has treacle in it, which is a bit like, I suppose, molasses, for a little bit of sweetness. So it's a little bit darker. And then we put seeds into it. So we put pumpkin seed, sunflower seeds, and some linseeds. I think the trick that I find with soda bread is that often it's quite dry, and so what I would recommend to people is that make it way wetter than you think that you so make it wetter than you can even handle it,
okay.
And then bake it wet in a loaf tin, and what that does is that it keeps the bread a lot moister.
Okay.
When you take it out, and also another trick is to bake it at a lower temperature. So we're very used to putting bread into the oven at about 180 degrees Celsius or 200 degrees Celsius. That's kind of the bread temperature. But if you bake your bread at 150 degrees Celsius or 160 degrees Celsius, you don't lose as much water from the bread, and it ends up being a lot moister. And so that's, I suppose, the two things that I would recommend. We have also a lovely cheese scone recipe, and it's in that thing that we give out. So I can send that over to you. And again, really, really beautiful scones that just have a kind of mature artisan cheddar that we fold into it. So they're a savory scone, but they're really, really great with some good butter.
JP, your idea of a cheese scone with really great farmhouse cheddar is giving me romantic feelings.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I will send you that recipe, and you can literally send it out, because recipes are there to, I suppose, to inspire people to cook, and they always, like, they're templates rather than things set in stone. So for me, it was important to, I don't know, for we get so many North American, I mean, about 70% of our diners in an ear are from the States or from,
from
North America. And so it's really important that they come over for the food experience. And sometimes they're going to the Cliffs of Moher, they're going to Connemara, or they might be going to Newgrange, or they're doing something in Ireland, and they want to get a food experience that emulates that. And so for me, it's important that not only do we feed them, but then they have something to go home with, and then they can continue that experience.
That's very giving, and that's amazing. I love the way you think. That's
so we
well. I would definitely send it on to you. If you email the restaurant, I will forward it on to you straight
Thank
away.
You.
And then any of your listeners, we can have see who does the best soda bread.
Mm-hmm.
We can get it posted on former Wolf page on the WIPR website.
Yeah, I can give you one of our Cava cookbooks, and then you can do a little whoever makes the best soda bread, you can give them a cookbook.
That's nice. How do you handle eel when you work with it? What do you like to do to it?
So eel is, for me, best smoked, and we get it, like, we outsource it when you smoke it, because it is, if anyone has ever smoked an eel or filleted an eel, it's a bit of a messy job.
Mm-hmm.
But I love smoked eel, and I think it pairs really well with potato. So you make a regular mash, and then fold the smoked eel through the mash.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure in any of the delicatessens or artisan stores, you should be able to source nice smoked eel. Whether it's from France or Holland or Ireland, but I mean, it's we don't often think about eel too much nowadays, and a lot of people have if they're older, they have like scarred memories of eating jellied eel, which is, I suppose, eel like literally just cooked in stock until, like, it's a very gelatinous fish. But there is a great delicacy to it as well, and unfortunately it doesn't have the PR that smoked salmon has. Unfortunately, I don't know who gave all the PR to the salmon, but the eel is just one of those slippery fishes, but it's a really great fish, and when you get it smoked, you can serve it as a canapé, or you can serve it in little tartlets, or whatever way you use smoked salmon. You can literally just change the recipe and use smoked eel.
I respect the non-desire to peel the eels. It is really one of the least fun jobs in a kitchen you could ever have.
100%. Or if you've ever had to nail an eel to the table to take the skin off it, you certainly won't forget that.
Well, thank you.
Well, hey, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
We really appreciate talking to you.
100%. And there's actually a friend of mine, Will Horowitz, down in New York. He smokes his own eel in Harry Anita's. He's in Brooklyn.
Excellent.
And so you can definitely get really good smoked eel stateside. And he loves that tradition as well of smoking eel. So you'll get smoked eel there.
All right, we'll check it out. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I have great affection for eel, actually, from Sardinia, where they will spirit cook it over a fire and then peel those guys.
Oh, yeah, I think anything cooked over fire for me there is a romantic attachment to it, of course, but I love the flavor that you get when you cook over fire, that kind of charred, that charred flavor.
Well, eel has enough flavor that they can handle it.
Oh,
well, that's, I think, probably before too long, you're going to see one of us over there.
Yeah, we'll come visit you.
Well, look, absolutely. You're welcome to come along. And don't forget to mail me for those recipes, because I'm sure some of your listeners will want to get into making some soda bread.
Thank you so much.
We will post them on the Formula Wolf page on the WIPR website. Thanks again, JP.
Great.
Yeah,
thank you for the time.
Not at all. A pleasure, and happy Paddock's Day to you too.
And
happy
to you. Thank you.
Cool.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was very cool.
That was cool. And I'm realizing, I was like, we can probably have we have a million different conversations we can have with this gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go. We have someone holding on the line, and you can still join us, 410-662-8780, if you have Irish stories, Irish recipes, or something entirely off the topic that we can help with. Siobhan, go ahead.
Hi. Both my mother and my father are from Ireland, and
excellent.
Growing up, our house was a revolving door of people coming and visiting.
Oh, nice.
And it was always with Irish sausages.
So what makes an Irish sausage an Irish sausage?
It's kind of, over here they refer to them as bangers, but they're really not as large as bangers, and it's just something that... It's a traditional food. They're a little bit different in every country, and the Irish sausages are the first thing when we get off the plane, we go and find them and have them.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
That's good.
I think that Yeats, when he won his literary prizes, was said that he wanted Irish sausages for dinner.
There you go. that comfort food.
So prize-winning sausage.
All the comfort food. Mm-hmm. And the other food that I don't think probably Americans are very familiar with is my uncle... owned a pub, and it was kind of a country pub,
mm-hmm.
and people would come from all over for the food, and it was very traditional food of crew beans and ribs, and the crew bean is the Irish word for feet, and it would be boiled pig's feet and boiled ribs with potatoes, veg, and it was a huge plate full of food, and have you ever had boiled pig's feet?
Yeah,
yes. Definitely,
and lots of pickles, pig's feet.
Yeah, they're not pickled; they're just boiled.
Yeah, pig's feet have a tremendous amount of gelatin in them, and what
exactly.
that does is it makes the sauce just whatever kind of broth or sauce you have working is going to be incredibly flavorful and have great viscosity. But yeah, pig's feet, they just don't have that much meat on them, so their value really truly is in what it does for the sauce. Mm.
Know that they served it with sauce. It was just the boiled pig's feet and ribs, and it was kind of sucking the bones of the feet.
Okay, then.
And clearing the bones.
Wow. It's still light out, Siobhan.
So that's what it was. I mean, it's not fancy food. It's just party food.
That's good.
Are you doing anything in particular to celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
Yes, I'm wearing all black because I'm in Baltimore instead of Ireland.
Wait, I don't understand.
We allow green.
I don't understand.
No, I'm kidding. I'm mourning.
I was going to say you're in mourning?
Aww.
It's nice here.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I know. I'm kidding. My family's there. So
okay.
I'd love to be with my family.
Well,
thanks for the call.
Very sweet. Thanks, Siobhan.
Good to talk with you.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
I've got an email from Willis and Waverly. Saying that all this talk of oysters and seaweed, he wants a recipe for oyster stew.
Oh, oyster stew? That's easy. Yeah. Okay, so the biggest thing to me about making oyster stew is that you add the oysters at the end, right before you serve it, so you don't overcook the oysters.
I mean, you don't boil the oysters in the God bless it broth for like an hour?
No, I do not.
So they become like little stony, salty pebbles?
Yeah, that's just not what you should do to those beautiful oysters. So get a beautifully, you know, a wonderful oyster that you like their flavor profile. Maybe they're a little salty, maybe they're a little sweeter, whatever kind you're going for. Shuck them, reserve every bit of that liquor, pass it through either a very fine sieve or preferably a cheesecloth in a sieve so you have no grit and no shell. And saute a little bit of onion and shallot and butter. Do not get any color. Saute it in a very small dice in butter. And then add the oyster liquor, cream, and a little bit of salt and pepper, and just let it work. And I like to add a small dice of potato. If you want that, add it right at the I boil it separately in salted water, so I'm certain it has the right amount of salt content. You can add that at the end with the oysters. And I add a little bit of fresh basil to mine, which is completely not traditional in any way, but basil is just something about that perfume from the basil in at the very end, or a little bit of fresh chives in at the end, or you could skip both of those things. It's up to you. But add the oysters right before you're serving, so your stew is going. I usually do 4 to 5 oysters per person, depending on how big they are, and pop them in there. And once you see those edges start to curl, you're there. And go ahead and serve it and just check it for seasoning, because your oysters will also impart some salt. So be careful with the amount of salt that you put in from the very beginning.
Yeah, maybe someone can make JP's soda bread and serve it with.
That sounds like fun.
Cindy's oysters too. You probably do all right.
There you go. Oh, I also had
a wee pint.
Yeah. I also add a drop of Tabasco. I add salt, pepper, and a drop of Tabasco to mine. But again, you don't have to do that. That's up to you.
So you can still sneak in at the end if you'd like. You can give us a call, 410-662-8780, with Irish food stories, factoids, family history, dirty laundry you want to air. You can email us also, formalwolf@wypr.org. And which is your favorite of the Irish cheeses that we've gotten over the years?
I think Keen's cheddar. I mean, it's just an amazing.
So not Duras.
I love Duras. When he mentioned that, I immediately wanted to jump out of my seat. Duras is an incredible piece of cheese. It's a washed rind piece. And I'm pretty sure it's most likely washed with saline salt water, and it is a cow's milk piece, Duras, and they weigh about 2 pounds.
It is so much like a Burgundian cheese.
Oh my goodness!
That and in technique, it's so much like a Burgundian washed rind cheese.
Like a poisson, you mean? Sort of like a poisson?
Sort of like a poisson or l'ami de Chambertin or maybe a cross between that and Citeaux, you know?
Yeah.
Where when he said that basically the Irish are ripped off by the French, and he said it in a more politically correct way, but it's like, you know, I can see that. I can see, because that's a spectacular cheese, and we've always had a good number of British Isle cheeses.
Yeah.
On restaurant trolleys, and
definitely, well,
and it's because of the quality, and they're not coming from cooperatives; they're actually coming from individual
producers, very small producers. You know, from the British Isles, we have Gabine as well, which is an incredible. And right now, if you can find that anywhere, I don't know if Neil's Yard Dairy, that's who sources it for us and brings it over from the UK, but I don't know if you can buy from them online. But oh my goodness, the Gabine right now is just absolutely incredible.
Gabine, GUBBEEN.
And yeah, Ticklemore is another one of my, I can't remember if that's Irish or not, but Ticklemore is an incredible piece of cheese. But we buy, you know, probably 10, 15 different types of cheeses from Great Britain that are just small producers and well-aged for us, cave-aged for us, and cellars in London and outside of London by Neil's Yard. And they do a great job. They're great affineurs and great supporters of those small producers, because you can imagine, if you're a small farmhouse producer, how do you sell your product? And how do you find someone to transport your product and age your product and take care of it the way that you would want it taken care of? And that's what Neil's Yard does. I mean, they're really an incredible company.
So before the program is over, I want to talk about Guinness.
Okay.
For a second.
All right. Did I just hear that we have a plant here in Baltimore?
We do.
That's so cool.
We do.
I didn't know that. And
what,
you can
what
go
I really
there
want to ask
visit.
Is about, okay. because I'm hungry now, mm-hmm. Guinness and recipes. Don't you use Guinness in one of your recipes?
Oh, my gumbo. I put, yeah. Is Guinness only dark? Is there more than one kind of Guinness? I forget.
There is more than one kind.
Okay, so
but,
the dark one. Yeah. That's the one I put in the gumbo. Excuse me, when I make duck gumbo, I think it's extremely important flavor profile to have in that gumbo because you make a dark roux, which is a 30 minute cooking time on a dark roux to get it truly beautifully flavored, mahogany in color, richly tasting and not burned. I mean, that is the whole thing with making a dark roux is not allowing it to burn. But with gumbo, with duck gumbo, I braise the duck legs and pull the meat. And but in the process of cooking them, I would add poblano peppers, onion, celery, and a lot of the vegetables, duck stock, dried basil, dried thyme, dried oregano, cayenne pepper, black pepper, salt, and those would be the spices that would go into the vegetables while they're cooking. Then the dark roux would be added in while the vegetables are cooking. Then you add the stock, let that thicken, let that work. Add the, you know, you've braised your duck legs. You're going to pull that meat off the bone. And near the end, I add the Guinness. And just, it's such a beautiful, beautiful component to that gumbo. And okra, of course. Yeah.
So, have you ever drunk one?
No, yes, back in the day.
Back in the day.
I used to drink
Your beer
Beck's
orientation
Dark
is limited.
And Guinness. Yeah, I don't.
Oh,
I'd,
wow.
Yeah, those were the beer, if I ever drank beer, other than, you know, back in those early college days. Yeah, when I was a young adult first cooking, and you go hang out. Yeah. I went to the Guinness plant in Amsterdam on my first trip to Europe in 1985. That was fun. That's a fun thing to do. I can imagine how great it is now.
I think a lot of people are visiting the...
I want to go to the one here. Yeah, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah, an interesting Baltimore thing to do now.
Mm-hmm. I also make a potato soup with Guinness in it. Yeah, Guinness has a lot of purposes.
That's probably pretty achievable for an awful lot of folks.
And a great cheddar in there. That's a good soup for the wintertime.
Well, if you want to download this and listen to the podcast of this program or any of the others, you can go to the Foreman Wolf page on the WIPR website, WIPR.org. If you want to email us about this or any of the topics, it's foremanwolf@WIPR.org. And if you want to follow Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf and on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. Thank you so much for listening.
And happy Sunday.
And happy St. Patrick's Day.